This podcast is brought to you by Lannan Foundation and is available at podcast.lannan.org.
A friend of mine, a very dear friend, just recently died. She was a terrific woman and kind of a patron, really. She put me up at a house and she helped me with my work, an English woman who came to live in Trinidad. And I thought I'd read a poem for her, not written directly for her, but with her spirit in it. As you get older, the number of people who have died seem to be more than the people you know. So this is called Sea Canes, for Veronica Jenkin, as of tonight. Half my friends are dead. I will make you new ones, said Earth. No, give me them back as they were instead, with false and all, I cried. Tonight I can catch their talk from the faint surf's drone through the canes, but I cannot walk on the moonlit leaves of ocean down that white road alone, or float with the dreaming motion of owls leaving Earth's load. O Earth, the number of friends you keep exceeds those left to be loved. The sea canes by the cliff flash green and silver. They were the seraph lances of my faith. But out of what is lost grows something stronger that has a rational radiance of stone, enduring moonlight further than despair, strong as the wind that through dividing canes brings those we love before us as they were, with faults and all. Not nobler, just there. Things do not explode. They fail. They fade. As sunlight fades from the flesh, as the foam drains quick in the sand. Even love's lightning flash has no thunderous end. It dies with the sound of flowers fading, like the flesh from sweating pumice stone. Everything shapes this, till we are left with the silence that surrounds Beethoven's head. The fist clenched round my heart loosens a little, and I gasp brightness. But it tightens again. When have I ever not loved the pain of love? But this has moved past love to mania. This has the strong clench of the madman. This is gripping the edge of unreason before plunging howling into the abyss. Hold heart, then heart. This way, at least you live. Love after love. The time will come when with elation you will greet yourself arriving at your own door in your own mirror, and each will smile at the other's welcome and say, sit here, eat. You will love again the stranger who was yourself. Give wine, give bread, give back your heart to itself, to the stranger who has loved you all your life, whom you ignored for another, who knows you by heart. Take down the love letters from the bookshelf, the photographs, the desperate notes. Peel your own image from the mirror. Sit, feast on your life. Names for Edward Braithwaite. My race began as the sea began, with no nouns and with no horizon, with pebbles under my tongue, with a different fix on the stars. But now my race is here in the sad oil of Levantine eyes, in the flags of the Indian fields. I began with no memory, I began with no future, but I looked for that moment when the mind was halved by a horizon. I have never found that moment when the mind was halved by a horizon. For the goldsmith from Benares, the stonecutter from Canton, as a fish line sinks, the horizon sinks in the memory. Have we melted into a mirror, leaving our souls behind? The goldsmith from Benares, the stonecutter from Canton, the bronze smith from Benin. A sea eagle screams from the rock. And my race began like the osprey with that cry, that terrible vowel, that I. Behind us all the sky folded as history folds over a fish line and the foam foreclosed with nothing in our hands but this stick to trace our names on the sand, which the sea erased again to our indifference. And when they named these bays, bays, was it nostalgia or irony? In the uncombed forest, in uncultivated grass, where was their elegance except in their mockery? Where were the courts of Castile, Versailles, colonnades supplanted by cabbage palms with Corinthian crests, belittling diminutives? Then little Versailles meant plans for a pigsty, names for the sour apples and green grapes of their exile. Their memory turned acid, but the names held. Valencia glows with the lanterns of oranges, Mayara's charred candelabra of cocoa. Being men, they could not live except they first presumed the right of everything to be a noun. The African acquiesce repeated and changed them. Listen, my children, say Mubin the hog plum, Suiz the wild cherry, Baila the bay, with the fresh green voices they were once themselves, the way the wind bends our natural inflections. These palms are greater than Versailles, for no man made them. Their fallen columns greater than Castile, no man unmade them, except the worm who has no helmet, but was always the emperor. And children, look at these stars over Valencia's forest. Not Ryan, not Betelgeuse. Tell me, what do they look like? Answer, you damn little Arabs. Sir, fireflies caught in molasses. Saint Lucie. Laborie, Choiselle, Vieuxfort, Dennery. From these sun-bleached villages where the church bell caves in the sides of one gray scurfed shack that is shuttered with warped boards with rust, with crabs crawling under the house shadow where the children played house, a net rotting among cans, the sea net of sunlight trawling the shallows and catching nothing all afternoon. From these I am growing no nearer to what secret eluded the children under the house shade, in the far bell, the noon's stunned amethystine sea. Something always being missed between the floating shadow and the pelican and the smoke from over the next bay, in that shack on the lip of the sand spit, whatever the seagulls cried out for through the gray drifting ladders of rain, and the great gray tree of the water spout, for which the dolphins kept diving, that should have rounded the day. Pomarac, Otaheite apple, Pomcite, Pomegranate, Mubin, Zanana, the pine apple's Aztec helmet, Pom, I have forgotten what Pom for the Irish potato, Cerise, the cherry, Zaman, sea almonds, where the crisp sea bursts, O Baudelaire. Come back to me, my language. Come back, Caco, Grigri, Solitaire, Caesar, the scissor bird. No nightingales except once in the indigo mountains of Jamaica, blue depth deep as coffee, flicker of pimento, the shaft light on a yellow ackee, the bark alone bare, jardin en montagne, en haut habitation, the wet leather reek of the hill donkey. Evening opens at a text of fireflies. In the mountain huts, tikai habitation, candles, candle flies, the black night bending cups in its hard palms, cool, thin water. This is important water. Important, imported. Water is important. Also very important, the red rust drum, the evening deep as coffee, the morning powerful, important coffee. The villages shut all day in the sun. In the empty schoolyard, teacher dead today, the fruit rotting yellow on the ground, dies from Gauguin, the pomarac dyes the earth purple, the ochre road still waiting in the sun for my shadow. Also, you is Walcott, you is Roddy brother, teacher Alex's son, and the small rivers with important names. And the important corporal in the country station, Habitation, looking towards the thick green slopes of cocoa, the sun that melts the asphalt at noon, and the woman in the shade of the breadfruit bent over the lip of the valley, below her blue, green, the lost valleys of sugar, the bus rides, the fields of bananas, the tanker still rusts in the lagoon at Roseau, and around what corner was uttered a single yellow leaf from the frangipani, a tough bark, reticent, but when it flowers, delivers hard lilies, pungent, recalling Martina or Eunice or Lucilla, who comes down the steps with the cool side flow as spring water eases over shelves of rock in some green ferny hole by the road in the mountains, a smile like the whole country, her smell earth, red brown earth, her armpits a reaping, her arms saplings, an old woman that she is now with other generations of daughters flowing down the steps, Jean Habitation, Belle tes feet Habitation, until their feet go and all the rest. O Martinas, Lucillas, I'm a wild golden apple that will burst with love of you and your men, those I never told enough with my young poet's eyes, crazy with the country, generations going, generations gone. Mais c'est Jean Saint-Lucie, c'est là moi sorti, it's there that I born. Volcano. Joyce was afraid of thunder, but lions roared at his funeral from the Zurich Zoo. Was it Zurich or Trieste? No matter. These are legends as much as the death of Joyce is a legend, or the strong rumor that Conrad is dead and that victory is ironic. On the edge of the night horizon from this beach house on the cliffs, there are now till dawn two glares from the miles out at sea derricks. They are like the glow of the cigar and the glow of the volcano at victory's end. One could abandon writing for the slow burning signals of the great, to be instead the ideal reader, ruminative, voracious, making the love of masterpieces superior to attempting to repeat or outdo them, and be the greatest reader in the world. At least it requires awe, which has been lost to our time. So many people have seen everything. So many people can predict. So many refuse to enter the silence of victory, the indolence that burns at the core. So many are no more than erect ash like the cigar. So many take thunder for granted. How common is the lightning? How lost the leviathans we no longer look for? There were giants in those days. In those days they made good cigars. I must read more carefully. Dark August. So much rain. so much life like the swollen sky of this black August. My sister, the sun, broods in her yellow room and won't come out. Everything goes to hell. The mountains fume like a kettle, rivers overrun. Still, she will not rise and turn off the rain. She's in her room fondling old things, my poems turning her album. Even if thunder falls like a crash of plates from the sky, she does not come out. Don't you know I love you, but I'm hopeless at fixing the rain. But I am learning slowly to love the dark days, the steaming hills, the air with gossiping mosquitoes, and to sip the medicine of bitterness, so that when you emerge, my sister, parting the beads of the rain with your forehead of flowers and eyes of forgiveness, all will not be as it was, but it will be true. You see, they will not let me love as I want, because my sister, then I would have learned to love black days like bright ones, the black rain, the white hills, when once I loved only my happiness and you. I'm going to read sections from a long poem called The Schooner Flight, which deals with set in Trinidad, a man who becomes a smuggler, but he's in league with a minister of government, and his name is Chabin. It should be really Chabin, meaning a person of mixed blood, a mulatto. And he is involved with a woman called Maria Concepcion. And at the beginning of this poem, they are breaking up and fighting, and she is going to leave him. But he sets out on a ship called the Flight, heading north. And as he heads north, he's reversing the direction of the Middle Passage, so he will see the slavers coming down the Caribbean. The Schooner Flight. Adios, Carenage. In idle August, while the sea soft and leaves of brown islands stick to the rim of this Caribbean, I blow out the light by the dreamless face of Maria Concepcion to ship as a seaman on the Schooner Flight. Out in the yard, turning gray in the dawn, I stood like a stone, and nothing else moved but the cold sea rippling like galvanized on the nail holes of stars in the sky roof, till a wind starts to interfere with the trees. I passed me dry neighbor sweeping she yard as I went downhill, and Anneli said, "Sweep soft, you witch, cause you don't sleep hard." But the bitch looked through me like I was dead. A route taxi pull up, park lights still on. The driver size up my bags with a grin. This time, Chabin like, "You're really gone?" I answer the ass. I simply pile in the back seat and watch the sky burn above Laventille, pink as the gown in which the woman I left was sleeping, and I look in the rear view and see a man exactly like me, and the man was weeping for the houses, the streets, that whole fucking island. Christ have mercy on all sleeping things. From that dog rotting down Wrightson Road to when I was a dog on these streets. If loving these islands must be my load, out of corruption my soul takes wings. But they had started to poison my soul with their big house, big car, big time bobble, coolie, nigger, Syrian and French Creole. So I leave it for them and their carnival. I taken a sea bath, I gone down the road. I know these islands from Monos to Nassau, a rusty head sailor with sea green eyes at the nickname Chabin, the patois for any red nigger, and I Chabin saw when these slums of empire was paradise. I'm just a red nigger who loved the sea. I had a sound colonial education. I have Dutch, nigger, and English in me. And either I'm nobody or I am a nation. But Maria Concepcion was all my thought, watching the sea heaving up and down as the port side of dories, schooners, and yachts was painted afresh by the strokes of the sun signing her name with every reflection. I knew when dark-haired evening put on her bright silk at sunset, and folding the sea, sidled under the sheet with her starry laugh, that there be no rest, there be no forgetting. It's like telling mourners around the graveside about resurrection. They want the dead back. So I smile to myself as the bow rope untied and the flight swings seaward. It's no use repeating that the sea have more fish. I ain't want her dressed in the sexless light of a seraph. I want these round brown eyes like a marmoset until the day when I can lean back and laugh. Those claws that tickled my back on sweating Sunday afternoons like a crab on wet sand. As I worked watching the rotting waves come past the bow that sitteth the sea like silk, I swear to all you, by my mother's milk, by the stars that shall fly from tonight's furnace, that I love them, my children, my wife, my home. I love them as poets love the poetry that kills them, as drowned sailors the sea. You ever look up from some lonely beach and see a far schooner? Well, when I write this poem, each phrase will be soaked in salt. I go draw a knot, every line as tight as ropes in this rigging. In simple speech, my common language go be the wind. My pages, the sails of the schooner flight. But let me tell you how this business begin. Shabin leaves the Republic. I had no nation now but the imagination. After the white man, the niggers didn't want me when the power swing to their side. The first chain my hands on apologize, history. The next said I wasn't black enough for their pride. Tell me what power on these unknown rocks, a spray plane air force, the fire brigade, the Red Cross, the regiment, 2-3 police dog that pass before you finish bawling parade. I met history once, but he didn't recognize me. A parchment Creole with warts like an old sea bottle crawling like a crab through the holes of shadow cast by the net of a grill balcony, cream linen, cream hat. I confront him and shout, "Sir, it's Shabin. They say I's your grandson. You remember grandma, your black cook at all?" The bitch hawk and spat. A spit like that worth any number of words. But that's all them bastards have left us. Words. I no longer believed in the revolution. I was losing faith in the love of my woman. I had seen that moment Alexander Block crystallized in the 12, was between the police marine branch and Hotel Venezuelana one Sunday at noon. Young men without flags, using shirts, their chests waiting for holes. They kept marching into the mountains, and their noise ceased as foam sinks into sand. They sank in the bright hills like rain, every one with his own nimbus, leaving shirts in the street and the echo of power at the end of the street. Propeller blade fans turn over the Senate. The judges, they say, still sweat in carmine. On Frederick Street, the idlers all marching by standing still. The budget turns a new leaf. In the 12:30 movies, the projectors best not break down or you're going to see revolution. Alexander Block enters and sits in the third row of pit, eating chocolate cone, waiting for a spaghetti western with Clint Eastwood and featuring Lee Van Cleef. The flight, passing Blanche says. Dusk, the flight, passing Blanche says. Gulls wheel like from a gun again, and foam gone amber that was white. Lighthouse and stars start making friends. Down every beach the long day ends. And there on that last stretch of sand, on a beach bare of all but light, dark hands start pulling in the seine of the dark sea, deep, deep inland. Shabin encounters the middle passage. Man, I brisk in the galley first thing next dawn, brewing little coffee. Fog coiled from the sea like the kettle steaming. When I put it down, slow, slow, cause I couldn't believe what I see. Where the horizon was one silver haze, the fog swirled and swelled into haze so close that I saw it was sails. My hair gripped my skull. It was horrors, but it was beautiful. We float through a rustling forest of ships with sails dry like paper. Behind the glass I saw men with rusty eye holes like cannons. And whenever the half-naked crews crossed the sun, right through their tissue, you traced their bones like leaves against the sunlight. Frigates, barkentines, the backward-moving current swept them on. And high on their decks I saw great admirals, Rodney, Nelson, de Grasse. I heard the hoarse orders they gave those Chavines, and the forests of masts sail right through the flight. And all you could hear was a ghostly sound of waves rustling like grass in a low wind, and the hissing weeds they trailed from the stern. Slowly they heaved past from east to west, like this round world was some cranked water wheel, every ship pouring like a wooden bucket dredged from the deep. My memory revolved on all sailors before me. Then the sun heat the horizon's ring, and they was missed. Next we passed slave ships, flags of all nations. Our fathers below deck, too deep, I suppose, to hear us shouting. So we stopped shouting. Who knows who his grandfather is, much less his name. Tomorrow, our landfall will be the Barbados. The flight anchors in Castries Harbor. When the stars' self were young over Castries, I loved you alone, and I loved the whole world. What does it matter that our lives are different, burdened with the loves of our different children, when I think of your young face washed by the wind, and your voice that chuckles in the slap of the sea? The lights are out on Latok Promontory, except for the hospital. Across at VG, the Marina Arcs keep vigil. I have kept my own promise to leave you the one thing I own, you whom I loved first, my poetry. We have one night here. Tomorrow, the flight will be gone. Fight with the crew. It had one bitch on board like he had me marked. That was the cook. Some Vincentian ass with a skin like a gommier tree, red peeling bark and washout blue eyes. He wouldn't give me a ease like he feel he was white. Had an exercise book, this same one here, that I was using to write my poetry. So one day this man snatched it from my hand and start throwing it left and right to the rest of the crew, bawling out, "Catch it," and start mincing me like I was some hen because of the poems. Some case is for fist. Some case is for tolling pin. Some is for knife. This one was for knife. Well, I beg him first, but he kept reading, "Oh, my children, my wife," and playing, he crying to make the crew laugh. It moved like a flying fish, the silver knight that catch him right in the pump of his calf, and he faint so slowly, and he turned more white than he thought he was. I suppose among men you need that sort of thing. It ain't right, but that's how it is. There wasn't much pain, just plenty blood. And Vincey and me best friend. But none of them gonna fuck with my poetry again. Coming to the end of it, the last couple of chapters, sections. Out of the depths. Next day, dark sea, the ass aching dawn. Damn wind shift sudden as a woman mind. The slow swells start cresting like some mountain range with snow on the top. "Hey, skipper, sky dark, this ain't right for August. This light damn strange. This season's sky should be clear as a field." A stingray steeplechase across the sea tail whipping water. The high man-o-wars start reeling inland. Quick, an archery of flying fish miss us. "Vincey, you notice?" And a black-maned squall pounce on the sail like a dog on a pigeon, and it snapped the neck of the flight and shake it from head to tail. "Be Jesus, I never see sea get so rough so fast. That wind come from God back pocket. We're captain heading like the man gone blind. If we're to drown, we're gonna drown, we're fuck it. Shabin, say your prayers if life leave you any. I have not loved those that I loved enough." Worse than the mule kick of Kickham Jenny Channel, rain start to pelt the flight between mountains of water. If I was frightened, the tenth poles of water spouts bracing the sky start wobbling. Clouds unstitch at the seams, and sky water drenches. And I hear myself cry, I'm the drowned sailor in her book of dreams. I remembered them ghost ships. I saw me corkscrewing to the seabed of sea worms, fathom past fathom, my jaw clenched like a fist, and only one thing hold me, trembling, how my family safe home. Then a strength like it seized me, and the strength said, I, from backward people who still fear God, let him in his might heave Leviathan upward by the winch of his will, the beast pouring lace from his sea bottom bed. And that was the faith that had fade from a child in the Methodist chapel in Chisel Street, Castries, when the whale bell sang service, and in hard pews ribbed like the whale, proud with despair, we sang how our race survived the seas more, our history, our peril. But now I was ready for whatever death will. But if that storm had strength, was in captain face, beard beading with spray, tears salting the eyes, crucified to his post, that nigger hold fast to that wheel, man like the cross hold Jesus, and the wounds of his eyes like they crying for us, and I feeding him white rum, while every crest with Leviathan lash make the flight quail like two criminal. Whole night with no rest, till red-eyed like dawn we watch our travail subside, and there was no more calm, there was no more storm, and the noon sea get calm as thy kingdom come. The final passage after the storm. There's a fresh light that follows a storm while the whole sea still havoc. In its bright wake I saw the veiled face of Maria Concepcion marrying the ocean, then drifting away in the widening lace of her bridal train. With white gulls her bridesmaid, still she was gone. I wanted nothing after that day. Across my own face, like the face of the sun, a light rain was falling with the sea calm. Fall gently, rain, on the sea's upturned face, like a girl showering. Make these islands fresh as Shabin once knew them. Let every trace, every hot road smell like clothes she just pressed and sprinkled with drizzle. I finished dream. Whatever the rain wash and the sun iron, the white clouds, the sea and sky with one seam is clothes enough for my nakedness. Though my flight never passed the incoming tide of this inland sea, beyond the loud reefs of the final Bahamas, I am satisfied if my hand gave voice to one people's grief. Open the map. More islands there, man, than peas on a tin plate, all different size. 1,000 in the Bahamas alone, from mountains to low scrub with coral keys. And from this bowsprit I bless every town, the blue smell of smoke in hills behind them, and the one small road winding down them like twine to the roofs below. I have only one theme, the bowsprit, the arrow, the longing, the lunging heart, the flight to a target whose aim we'll never know, vain search for one island that heals with its harbor and a guiltless horizon, where the almond's shadow doesn't injure the sand. There are so many islands as the stars at night on that branched tree from which meteors are shaken like falling fruit around the schooner flight. But things must fall, and so it always was. On one hand, Venus, on the other, Mars. Fall and our one, just as the earth is one island in archipelagos of stars. My first friend was the sea. Now is my last. I stop talking now. I work, then I read. Clutching under a lantern hooked to the mast, I try to forget what happiness was. And when that don't work, I study the stars. Sometimes it's just me and the soft scissored foam as the deck turn white, and the moon open a cloud like a door, and the light over me is a road in white moonlight taking me home, shall be in song to you from the depths of the sea. Thank you.
That concludes the reading for this event. Up next is the conversation.
Auden said that to ask the hard question is simple, and I'm going to ask you one I probably regret asking, but there's a word that echoes down all your work like a sort of tolling bell, a kind of tonic note. And I'm thinking of the word home and what it means and what it means now, where you teach in Boston, you fly in from New York. Neither of them are home, but when I first met you, Boston was a kind of home, and New York's a kind of home. In the work, in the Gulf, you talk of the Old South as feeling like home. You describe England elsewhere as half home. In Homeros, there's an extraordinary pivot in the middle, a fulcrum in the middle of the poem, the couplets, where House of Umbrage, House of Fear, which ends with the word home. And I wonder where home is for you now. Is it a place? Is it a time? Is it a time? How does your work deal with that sense?
I guess there are certain words that poets use a lot that they're not aware of, that they do use a lot. But I think I have to use it because I'm constantly shifting, not allegiances, but locations. I've grown very, very attached to the village, not the one in St. Lucia, the other one in New York. And I find things there that are a little stronger now, physically, little things that have a strong pull, which is what home really is. So I have that sensation as well. But I think in a general sense, the feeling that I'm not really settled in any one place. I mean settled, I mean there's no threat of having to move, that you really are here and you're going to be here for the rest of your life. Not as a sentence, but as something you can have to use all the time you can for. I do a lot of painting, and you can't paint in a landscape that doesn't suit you, and especially a cityscape. According to someone I told once, you know, I don't do windows. Too hard. But the more time, the more you paint, the more you need that expansion of time for you to work on a picture. It's not like writing, in which you can stop fairly early while you're working at something. In other words, the actual theme of what you're doing, working on a poem, I think, or even a section, a prose section of something you're working on, doesn't last very long. I think one tires very quickly of continuous thought. It isn't that you don't think in painting, but the process is very, very different. What that has to do with home has to do considerably with the reality of the landscape, that the landscape that I live in has not been painted too much, which makes you feel very proprietary, and it is, you know, it's all there for you in a way, to clarify, to illustrate. So I have that very strong sense of possession, of hoping to possess physically when I am in St. Lucia, which I manifest, of course, in painting and in language too, but now primarily in painting.
Of course, considering home, there's also, because I read through all your work again in its right chronology, I was struck by how one of the first articulations of what it means to be a poet, what it feels like to be the person you are, it seems to me in the, you put into the voice of Robinson Crusoe as a castaway. And later on you have poems like The Light of the World, which deals with the terrible sort of paradox at the heart of a poet's life, that a poet tries to write the universe, or tries to write for the community, tries to write from a place, and it's particularly acute for you because you are seen as a poet of a certain place, of a certain people, and Yet the more that you become that, does it become difficult to be that, to be among it?
Yeah, one of the ironies of being a West Indian writer of some reputation is that the more the reputation grows, or the more you have an output as a writer, in a way, the more you're alienating yourself from your own society, because it is in reality, especially the smaller islands, I don't like those definitions at all, but I have to use them, you know, statistically, semi-literate society, where people can't afford to buy books or don't buy books, and where the readership is limited to a certain number of people. I try not to think of the amount of people, the few people who may be reading my work in the Caribbean, not in the Caribbean, but particularly, say, in St. Lucia, where I'm from, where there's a bilingual society, mainly in French Creole, and where the price of a book is beyond the reach of the average person. So how can you possibly maintain a balance between who you are, who you're writing for, and the fact that it isn't that you're not reaching them, but you can't imagine that you could have a public of any real scale. That doesn't stop me from what I'm doing, because I don't think that my real task is to articulate a people's problems, politically, certainly not. But because I try to utter whatever it is I think they may be feeling, that very utterance is one that kind of separates you from the person you may be writing for who is not reading you. And we have brilliant writers, and we do not have a large reading population. Maybe that's what should happen. It should be just very good readers, a few of them.
I just wondered, in terms also of the stage in your life and your career and how many books you've written and so on, the stage you are now. I remember a long time ago when I'd recently been your student, and occasionally I'd phone you up in London hotels and bother you with my own problems about my work, and you'd be very patient with it. I asked you if you'd been writing any sort of short poems, any sort of lyric poems lately. I thought this is what you do with a poet like Derek, you ask questions like this. And you said you were a little tired of moi. And I took that at the time to mean, it awakened something that I was starting to be aware of, that one could sit down and start trying to do the work again, and then hear the voice, hear a certain voice, and think, I'm tired of that voice, I need something else. I don't believe it. Do you have moments like that where you reach a platform, like a plateau, where you feel it needs a different thing, or to step back for a while?
I think what I'm going through is very curious, and it's been going on for some time. It is a cynicism, in a way, of the too finished poem, the thing that designs itself and closes and becomes an object that you can, you know, look at or handle or move around, that finished object then becomes something called a poem, which then becomes part of something called poetry, and which has got to have, for it to have any kind of, to carry any impression at all, has got to follow a certain symmetry, whether it's in free verse or a long line. It is starting at the beginning and going towards an end. And maybe there's something too presumptuous, perhaps, in the finiteness that may be there in the lyric, the presumption on the part of the lyric poet that he knows how his feeling is going to end, and that it's going to end with a kind of predictable symmetry, like a dying fall, or refusal to do a dying fall, which is the same thing. And that kind of thing I have moved away from, perhaps closer to what fiction in a way does. That may just be an excuse for not being able to write short poems or any good. I don't think so. I think that I have not been able to do one or interested in a way in doing one. It may also be the fact that one likes to get up to something in the morning. And if you do a lyric poem, you know, in half an hour, if it comes right, then you're through for the day, you know.
I think, not to be flippant,
but there's something about egocentricity in the lyric that I have a problem with. I think it may have also to do with age. I've been writing a long time now, and it may be a kind of a fatigue. But it also is, when I go to a bookstore or I get a book, get a magazine, and then I start to open it and I start to look at poems, I have an antecedent echo of what I'm going to read. I know, I have a feel of it is going to be going that way, yes, I see, now we're in the middle, and here comes the ending, in a way. And it's that, I think, that I've had a problem with of late. It may be that experience, there should have been wisdom where now there's more irascibility.
In terms of wisdom and irascibility, I was just thinking of you as a teacher, actually. And because you've taught in many
places. Let me interrupt, Glenn, to say something. That's not abusing a teacher's privilege, no. I teach what they call creative writing. And, you know, you say that in Europe and everybody laughs. Say, it's impossible, you can't do it, you know. You can do it. You can be a mentor or a guide to any writer at any stage in his life, particularly a young writer. Any young artist has mentors. So there's nothing wrong. It's how you do it. It's the method with which you do it. If you don't try to force something onto a writer, you know, an imitation of who you are or what you do. And in any case, the people who do come into these programs are coming in already talented. And in Glenn Maxwell's case, who came in was a genius, a brilliant young poet of genius. So to refer to me as his teacher, which I guess I was, is not to say that, you know, he got it from me. It's just that this is there, and what develops, of course, is entirely his own planning. So I want to make that clear. There's no sort of pupil-teacher relationship, basically.
Yes, perhaps in terms of the work, but sort of psychologically in terms of character.
Okay, Glenn, you win.
Well, I guess I'm just thinking of teaching in terms of, you've taught in quite a few places, but you've taught for many years at Boston University, so you've been teaching the same kind of group. And I wondered if you see any change in the kind of people who are coming to you as aspiring young poets of America or beyond.
I think that people who have come out of the program, we have had about, you know, easily 15 poets published from that program. And each one is genuinely different. They're not like, you know, cookie cutter poets coming out in a certain way. It's individual styles, individual vocabulary and approach. So that's very rich. And to see that, and to see that happen under your nose, it's a very, very exciting. It's very exciting to see a young writer finding himself or herself. I find it so. But you have to know how much rein to give them, how much slack to give, so they can go far out without feeling that there's some restraining pull on what they're doing. The teaching of poetry and the learning of it as a craft is the greatest thing that can happen to any republic. Because if you learn the craft of verse, then you can't be fooled easily. you can't take in rhetoric. Rhetoric is not part of the stuff that you absorb. So it's not a matter of not believing. It's a matter of saying that when you say this, basically the language you're using is a language of lies. And that's what a young poet or young poets in a republic do. That because they have to be devastatingly honest with themselves, if they can turn that outward to society, then it's of an immense good to any society to teach young poets.
I've only been doing it for 3 years, but I know it's not easy, in fact, because, well, occasionally in the heat of one of these sessions with the graduate students and so on, I find myself in the position of having to do things like defend rhyme per se, defend the whole idea of any kind of metrical structure or any pattern whatever. And at moments like that, I raise my eyes and think, what would Derek do at this point? And so I'm asking you now. What? Is there something happening? Is there a shift where every generation you're going to have to go further back?
I think at the rate things are going, poetry will lose its audience entirely. I think nobody will read it anymore because they don't understand what this stuff is. I read it and I don't understand it. I'm serious. I read a lot of stuff by known names that I won't mention, that I just say, this is incomprehensible to me, and I'm not going to bother to strain to do it. I don't consider poetry to be a riddle, an enigma, or, you know, a formula. What I look for is not that. It's not that sort of conspicuous, you know, dance of intellect that people think has to do with the craft of verse. I want to be able to understand what I'm reading. And I now abandon anything that I can't understand. Because I think the function of language is to do that, to make at least not the communicating idea of language, but in the presence, the reality of the presence of language. And what is in vogue, obviously, is obscurity. So you have a sort of a chain of uncommand in which, whether it's rhyme or whether it's symmetry of a certain kind, is not taught. This is the only country I imagine where young students have told me, I'm trying to get rid of melody. That's a fact. You know, and since I come from a backward, underdeveloped country, I think, well, thank God I haven't gotten there yet.
Another way in which, to keep going back to things you told me a long time ago, it's probably not quite fair, but another way you said that that I personally could get out of the egocentric, the lyric moi and so on, was to write plays, which I sort of started doing in your class. You've written many plays, you've been part of the theatre for decades now. What drew you there? What keeps you there? And what do you find there that is different from what you find in verse? What kind of other thing does it bring to the line, to the whole practice, to your life?
Well, the theater I write for is a Caribbean theater. I'm writing about poor black people, generally, living on a small island or in a large-ish island, but people whose experience is parochial and confined to that area. But I'm also writing, I think, in one of the richest, historically richest areas of the world, and that is a place in which all the races are represented, Chinese, you know, Indian, Lebanese, all are there, for instance, in Trinidad, and that my heritage then is a Chinese play, I feel, is as much my heritage as a play by, you know, by an Indian writing classical Indian theater or using it. So that we have this rich reality of Trinidad, to take it as a specific example. And plus, of course, any writer would delight in the fact that in any one island, for instance, there are always four languages. There's a language of, let's say, English. There's English, standard St. Lucian English, and then there's English. And then there is French Creole, and then there's translated French Creole into English. So you have a whole simultaneity of melodies going on that is very bewitching, very enriching, and very lucky to be working in, because it doesn't have that kind of neutrality and grayness of the average language in an urban context. Even that has its own patois, which can be great, but does not have that universal, huge variety that is visible even in Trinidad. So the other thing is that I write my plays in verse. I remember, I've never forgotten a time when an English producer from the BBC came to probably Trinidad, and I showed her a play I was working on, and it was in verse. And what she said was, she gave it back to me and said, "Well, we don't do this anymore." You see, you have to always apologize for being late if you're from the Caribbean. Like, we don't paint anymore, we install these days.
Do you think, in fact, I mean, this is an old thing, do you think poetry can work on the stage in any form other than the sort of museum pieces that return to the stage occasionally? Or on Broadway now, there's a showcase of several performance-based poets.
That's really show business. That's a different thing. Poetry works on stage because the best plays approach it. That's what they get to when they're really fine. They get approximate to poetry. They get very close to it. And I mean language. So the discouraging of poetry in the theater is because people have an imagination in which they think what they're going to hear is echoes, Shakespearean echoes or whatever. But American diction in poetry, since the First World War, is the most valuable, the most colloquial, the richest sound that poetry has had since the Elizabethans in terms of its access and colloquiality. American poetry is immediately theatrical, not for historical reasons, just the nature of what it is. So that you can take sections from Frost, E.E. Cummings, and other poets, and if you just hear that language on stage, it's totally electrifying. And the discouraging of that by people who say, well, poets have no right in the theater, is what has prevented, I think, the presence of poets in the theater, because they are discouraged from writing for it. Now, I'm not talking about a kind of play in which, you know, there's a black curtain and somebody comes out in a blue veil and does a weird dance.
So I'm going to stop writing that one now, okay?
Do a sequel.
Yeah.
The poetry I'm talking about is raw. It's shaped by the poet, but it comes from that sound. You can take certain poets and immediately hear them as drama, theatrical language, whether it's Phil Levine or Charlie Simic or all. There's all that immediacy of speech that is there. And yet this country ignores the presence of the theater, of the poet in the theater, because they're simply discouraged from thinking that they know anything about a play. Nobody knows anything about a play except enter and exit. There's nothing to learn in the craft of playwriting. I know. Because I haven't learned anything.
I'm being flashed at by the technology. So I would simply like to say that it's been a privilege and a delight to introduce and interview Derek Walcott, and thank you all for coming. And thank you, Derek.
You've been listening to a Lannan podcast. You can subscribe to our podcasts at podcast.lannan.org. In addition, the Lannan Audio Archives present similar programs by national and international writers, poets, and social activists at www.lannan.org. Listen to hundreds of hours of recorded programs from the likes of Seamus Heaney, Joy Harjo, Eduardo Galeano, Arundhati Roy, Jim Harrison, Edwidge Danticat, and Noam Chomsky. New programs are added every month to both the podcasts and the audio archives.